So we're going to just spend like 5 minutes on the green sheets and we'll refer back to them. But first, just how do you feel after reading those? Tell me feelings. That makes you feel, it makes you feel anxious? Okay. How to respond? Obligated? What do you mean? Okay. Yeah, their crisis feels like your crisis now, so now you feel obligated. Other feelings, front of mind, or?
Well, it might be the same thing.
Skeptical? Yeah?
You feel doubtful whether you're doing the right thing.
Skeptical, doubtful. If you're doing the right thing regardless of the choice you make. Yeah, that's a good way to put it. I often feel that way about how we respond to the homeless if they ask for a handout. You know, when somebody is standing on the side of the road and they ask for a dollar, Christians do one of three things. What are they?
We're all going directly to discernment, I think. Every one of us who's regenerated, we're going to discernment.
So discernment is where your brain is quickly going, right? And there's something about these situations that can make us feel skeptical, helpful, as we're trying to discern. And so with that homeless guy asking for a dollar, some people just give no money. And how do you feel? You feel guilty. Or you give a dollar and you keep walking, and how do you feel?
Guilty
or used. So either way, we're not real comfortable with how we do it. And occasionally, you'll be that person who says, come here, man, let's sit down, let's have a burger, and you talk with the guy for 20 minutes, and then you feel better. But we're all kind of dissatisfied with our response to that. And I think there's a similarity with these kind of situations, is we feel like our response is insufficient in either way, whether we say yes or no. So we're going to come back to some of these in a little bit, some more specifics. But looking just to, so you have a little bit of context. So I was a deacon at my church, PCA Church, Alexandria Prez. We are 4 miles from the Pentagon, right outside D.C. So we're in urban context, but kind of suburban in some ways. I'm pastor of Mercy at the church now, so I work with the deacons and the Mercy Committee in responding to calls from the community and taking care of our own congregation. We get 2 to 5 calls every week, and 2 to 3 times a month somebody knocking on the door saying, can you help me with this financial need? And so I've been taking those phone calls for years, and I take my notes. And so all of those things you read are actual people I've spoken to over the years, and those are my notes summarized from those different conversations. So what I want to talk about today, focusing in, is specifically on this responding to people from outside the church asking for help. There's many other dimensions of Mercy ministry, and we'll like touch on them, but focusing especially on this particular problem, how do you respond to these calls? And the one question I didn't ask on the green one, who at your churches, just briefly, handles these phone calls?
Secretary.
The secretary? Daniel, deacon at his church?
Secretary or comes through, you know, during church service?
Yeah. An answering machine. Really? Does the answering machine say anything about if you're calling to have financial assistance do this? Just a generic message. So if somebody's calling for utility assistance, they're not going to get anywhere.
Yeah. Or a lot of times they don't even try to leave anything.
Right. So they're like, there's no human being there, go to the next church in the phone book. Okay. And what I feel for is the administrative people in our churches who often end up having to respond to people who launch into this litany of explanation about their need. And she's like, I signed up to print the bulletin. Why am I suddenly doing the deacon's job by answering this phone call? So that's one of the things we can talk about a little bit. So my iPad's losing connection here sometimes. That's all right. We can move physically. So it begins with a phone call, right? And they often say, can I speak to the pastor? That's very often the very first thing that happens. Why do people say that first?
Pastors are softies and want to help everyone.
Exactly. People know that. They know that the pastor is usually a compassionate person, and if I can get the pastor on the phone, if the pastor will just let me explain what's going on, then I'm going to get the help I need. And in a lot of smaller churches, the pastor is the only decision maker. I mean, in Bible churches, churches that don't have deacons, the pastor is the one who controls the purse strings anyway. So people are in a habit of often saying, can I speak to the pastor? Is it the pastor's job to deal with this? So one of the things that we want to figure out is who should be handling these calls so that it's not falling on the administrative person who answers the phone, nor on the pastor. Because when a person calls and says, can I speak to the pastor, rarely is someone really looking for pastoral. They're very often just calling for financial assistance. And we're not trying to paint anybody in a box, and we're using broad brushes here and big generalizations. And so just give me the benefit of the doubt on that. But when I'm going to have to go physically with this thing. That's why we got the big cable. Did I unhook it? I did. Sorry. Give me a second. Give me, while I'm messing with this, tell me any other thoughts from the green sheet. What would you do in any of those cases? Did you have one that you knew exactly what your church would do?
It's interesting at the top, you said, what would your church do? But then at the bottom, each question is, what would you do? And they're different
things. Okay, what do you mean? Why are they different things? And you have time to do that?
Sometimes.
I'm glad you do.
Not
good.
All
right. Are you a deacon?
I'm not.
Okay. Used to be a deacon. So you have a deacon's heart.
But what amazes me, though, I work in a multicultural hood where I'm studying.
Yeah.
And all the churches that are in that area, I'm more of a nonprofit than a school church. My families would never receive help from any of their churches.
Why?
Because they don't do that.
The churches don't do that. Correct. So kind of like what we heard from Mike this
right.
morning, we don't do that.
Right. Whereas I would receive a text saying I need money to... Mm-hmm. Respond and say, if you'd asked me a day or two in advance, I'd help you. If you ask me the minute before it's going to go, shoot, then you know I'm busy. To help them perceive the fact this is something they should be thinking about.
Planning ahead, yes. Yes. That's good, thank you. So we're going to talk about the mistakes that people often make in churches. So we talked about who takes it. What happens? So the two mistakes, I think, are to quickly say yes to everybody. And I know churches that do that. They set a budget, and they say, we're going to give out $5,000 a month. And we'll just say yes to everybody till the money runs out. And I think that's a mistake. We'll talk about why. The other mistake is to say, we don't do that. And just say, no, we don't help anybody from outside the church. We don't do financial help. That's a mistake. The harder... better answer is to actually engage with people, to actually get involved. So let's unpack the first mistake. So the first one is material help alone. Is if you just say yes to everybody and you only provide them with financial assistance, then you're not recognizing the reason why people have financial trouble, why there's suffering in the world. Is you're thinking that material problems require material solutions and you're not thinking bigger than that. And as Mike did really well this morning, talking about what the purpose of the church actually is. It's not about the social gospel. What's the social gospel? Anybody define the social gospel? I mean, we talk about why it's bad.
Fix all the problems in the world without Jesus.
Yes. And the reason they focus on fixing the problems in the world is because Jesus died to save the world. Everyone's already saved. They just haven't experienced their salvation yet. So the social gospel literally says that Jesus died for the sins of the world. Everybody's forgiven. They just haven't experienced the material benefits of salvation yet. And so the church's job is to make the material benefits present. But the salvation's already happened. And what we believe is that people are fractured, that all the suffering in the world exists because we're broken in our relationship with God. When Adam and Eve ate the fruit, they were saying, God, you know what? We don't need you. We think we'd be better off on our own, making our own decisions. And God said, oh, my children, you need me so much more than you realize. And the fall is tangible evidence that we're broken and separated from our Creator. And so all the suffering we encounter is a symptom of a broken relationship with the Creator. And what's the church's role, given that fact?
To redeem that brokenness.
To redeem that brokenness and restore people back to their Creator, to bring about restoration. That's our mission. That's our purpose. And so if you are a church that quickly says yes to everybody, you're going to run out of money and you're going to run out of patience and you're going to spin your wheels and accomplish very little in a lasting kingdom sense. Yes, people will get their gas bills paid, and yes, their rent will be paid, but what'll happen the next month?
Same thing.
Exactly. And it sounds like you see that all the time.
Yeah, I'd rather say that poverty is a byproduct of broken relationships first before talking about the monetary issue.
Yes.
And until you resolve the brokenness, the monetary issue is still going to be the crisis that comes.
Right. So that's another way of saying, yeah, that the monetary problems are symptoms of broken relationships, vertical and horizontal broken relationships, right? Because the fractured relationship vertically results in these broken relationships horizontally. You remember Mike mentioned today, where do people go first when they have a financial need? Who do they go to first? Family and friends. If someone is calling through the phone book asking strangers for financial help, where did they go first before they called you? Where did we just say? Family and friends. Why are they now moving on to their second option? Because they've exhausted the resources among their family and friends. They've burnt those bridges or they've used up those resources, and now they're at the point where they're calling strangers on the phone asking for money. It's a symptom of this dysfunctional relationships that are going on. And just throwing money at the problem doesn't solve the underlying issue. So we're still on quick yes is not good, because Jesus had compassion on people and he dealt with their physical problems. He healed them physically. He fed them. But what does it say, the Mark 6 passage? Why did he have compassion on the 5,000? What does it say? He had compassion on them because they forgot their lunch. Is that what it says? Because they were sheep who needed a shepherd, because they needed him. And that's what aroused his compassion. And so feeding them was a sign. Do you ever notice what John calls Jesus' miracles over and over and over in the Gospel of John? I just said the word. He calls them signs. He doesn't call them miracles. Why? Because they pointed to something greater. They were signs of the kingdom pointing to what the kingdom is like. That the kingdom of God is a place where there is not poverty, there is not hunger, there is not brokenness. And we give people a glimpse of that greater reality by doing tangible deeds of mercy and giving material aid, but always recognizing that it's only a sign that points you back to Jesus. That's pointing you back to God. And I love the proactive work of God that has seen the suffering and comes down to rescue them, not responding, not being only reactive, but being proactive. So, mistake number two, and please, I like to talk and interact and answer questions, so stop me at some point, interrupt me if you have to ask a question. Mistake two, so saying no to everybody. This often happens after a church has said yes to everybody for a while, right? They're like, we're not doing that anymore. Close the doors. Lifeboat mentality. Lifeboat mentality is, hey, we're saved, and our job is to keep ourselves and our children safe from the rest of the world. And so let's close the doors, lock the gates, And if the Lord, you know, and we're Reformed. So if the Lord wants to save some of those people over there, he will. And he'll bring them here. But we're just going to take care of our people in our holy huddle and be safe. And so you can become cynical quickly and decide everybody's a scammer, everybody's a liar, and we limit our assistance to those who obviously deserve the help. What's wrong with that?
I'm always asked, last weekend we painted 5 houses with 150 volunteers, so I'll get the question, how do you decide who's a worthy recipient?
Worthy recipient. Who are the deserving poor?
Yeah. And so I pretty much, you know, with that and go, well, nobody's really a worthy recipient, but yet God chooses to
yes.
display his grace in, you know, obvious ways.
Yeah.
But there's always a tension. So I'll have somebody paint a house, and it'll turn out that the families that are there will help out most of the time. Sometimes they won't. And so the purpose isn't to see the family help out. It is. But you'll have a few cousins or uncles that are drinking beer watching a football game. So there'll be one person who will complain and go, well, why do we do that? And my point is, well, you just showed an example of somebody giving without expecting anything in return.
That's right.
That's the gospel.
Exactly.
The real goal, though, is, you know, self-sufficiency, to come back in Christ and understand your responsibility to own your life.
Right. And we have a desire sometimes to try to figure out who's deserving and who's worthy. And I think there's a sinful thing behind that, because we want to help the people that we think merit it, who have deserved it in some way, and that we're the ones with the discernment to figure out who they are. But if Christ used the same criteria and said, oh, I'm going to come and save Adrian because he's deserving of my death on the cross. Right? Is that how he decided who to save? He saved us because we were worthy of being saved? But no, while we were yet sinners, while we were drunk on the couch. You know, I remember putting a roof on a house in Mississippi after Katrina, and we were ripping off the old rotted sheathing, and somebody said, whoa, be careful. And pieces of the rotted plywood we were pulling up off the roof were falling down on the guy who was passed out drunk on the couch right under the roof. And this is like 2 in the afternoon, and he's blotto on the couch as pieces of plywood are falling on him. And, like, do we stop putting roof on his house? Hey, this guy's an able-bodied man in his 20s. He should be, stop the work. This guy doesn't deserve our help. No. So, the danger of working with people for a while is that the cynicism is always trying to crop up, and we look for excuses, and we start to try to put people in boxes, and we put them in categories, but recognizing that every person is unique, you don't really know where they are. And, I mean, I've sat with people for the very first time and start hearing their story and getting to know them, and I know that what they just said wasn't true. Does that mean I stop? Because that person just told me something that wasn't true, or they embellished it? Think about it. If you have been in desperate situations for a long time, if you have been mistreated and abused in your life, if you've had a dysfunctional life, and you're sitting down for the first time with this guy you don't know, are you going to be completely transparent about everything the first time? I mean, are you like that with the person next to you on the plane? You don't just spill your story. Might you shade the truth or embellish it a little bit? So recognizing that people are coming with all kinds of brokenness, and don't be surprised by it. Questions, comments?
My church is right on the freeway.
Uh-huh.
I mean, that's the front of our church is frontage road, and we get sometimes 5-6 a week.
Yeah.
Folks walk in.
Walk-ins.
Get many calls.
Okay.
I did. When I first got there, I thought, oh, this is what a great ministry opportunity. And then before long, it just turned into a beating of, all right, how much of this do I have to listen to before I can call you on your BS?
Yeah.
It's,
I hear
it's
you.
Callous.
No, thanks for being honest, because I'm with you.
Yeah.
And do you respond to him?
Whoever We have a point deacon who starts the process. And we do the When Helping Works, or When Helping Hurts ministry with each of these folks. And most of them run off because they're not interested in that.
They're not interested in going deeper. They want, what do they usually ask for?
Gas rent utilities.
Gas rent utilities. And if you're not going to give it quickly.
Right, I ain't got time.
Okay, I got to move on. I got to solve this problem. I'm glad you're in trying to engage. How to engage well in a way that doesn't get you cynical and burned out and actually helps is the hard thing.
Can you fix that for me?
Yeah. I got a pill in my bag. And the next slide will solve all your problems. The thing is, I mean, human beings are a mess. And the reason why I think the quick yes and the quick no are so common is because they're easier and because we're selfish. We're just selfish. We would rather not get involved in someone else's mess. We would rather do ministry that's easy and predictable and has guaranteed outcomes. We'd rather do a plug-and-play thing like, okay, tutoring, I need to be there from 3:30 to 4:30 and help a cute third grader with her math. Yeah, sign me up. That has clear boundaries, a clear schedule, and it's not going to demand too much of me. Doesn't that ministry sound a lot more attractive than what he just described? It does, because we don't like messy, difficult situations that we can't control. And those are exactly the kind of things God loves to do. And he loves to use us in it, messed up and confused. And you will not get to a place where you know the answers and you can figure it out. I still get scammed. I still don't know what to do. And that's why we don't do it alone either. So let's keep going, and we'll keep discussing as we go. This is still answering the question why you can't just say no, okay? Why we have to do something. So as burnt out as you feel, brother, and as cynical as you feel with these guys coming in every week, we have to do mercy. So mercy is a requirement. You know the Micah 6:8 verse, he's told you, man, what is good, what does the Lord require of you? To do justice, love kindness, walk humbly. And to love kindness, other verses say to love mercy. And it's not just to love the idea of mercy. So this is something I'll confess that I've often been guilty of. I love the idea of mercy. I would rather spend an hour 15 minutes talking to you about this than an hour 15 minutes sitting with an addict or a single mom or visiting a person in the hospital. This is easier. So I would rather talk about mercy and kindness than do it because I'm selfish. But we are called to love and to do the justice and mercy because that is how God has treated us. So Sodom and Gomorrah. Don't say it out loud, but the sin of Sodom and Gomorrah that pops to everybody's mind. Got in your mind what they were condemned for? See if it jives with what Ezekiel says that the sin of Sodom and Gomorrah was. This was the sin of Sodom. She and her daughters were arrogant, overfed, and unconcerned. They did not help the poor and needy. They were haughty and did detestable things. Therefore, I did away with them. Is that what you had in mind? It's not what comes to mind when we say Sodom and Gomorrah. Ezekiel doesn't mention that other sin that it pops into everybody's mind when you say Sodom and Gomorrah. He doesn't even mention that. I find it very convicting to think not only of our churches, but especially the PCA, which is a predominantly upper middle class, comfortable, pretty well educated denomination. And I think it's safe to say that a lot of our churches are arrogant, overfed, and unconcerned. And God has some harsh words to say to us about that. And so, mercy is required. Anyone want to push back on that? All right. All right? So the question is, what will we do that is truly merciful? In Keller's book, Ministries of Mercy, got one little line that I quote in that book more than anything else, is he says, only mercy should limit mercy. And so we must be merciful. The question is, what is truly merciful? We had a member of our church who, I shouldn't use the past tense, he's still back and forth on drugs, on alcohol, in and out of shelters. And so this is a covenant member of our church. And we have put him into drug programs. We've put him into city shelters. We took him to Teen Challenge and enrolled him, paid the $700 entry fee. He leaves once on his own. And they said, that's your last chance. If you leave again, you can't go back. And so sat down with him, and I said, look, we're going to drive you back 3 hours to the mountains, take you back to the program. If you leave again, is the church going to put you in a hotel? And he said, no. And I said, you're right, we're not. Is the city shelter going to take you back after you've already been there for 180 days this year and you've left twice against their advice? Are they going to take you back? No. I said, so we just want to be clear. We're going to take you back to the program. If you leave, where will you be sleeping? On a bench. Like, all right. So 3 weeks later, there he is in church, smelly, stinky, been sleeping on a bench for 3 days, and said, look, I'm not trying to rub your face in it. I'm not trying to beat you up, brother. But why are you sleeping on a bench right now? Because I left the program. And we talked about that. I know. Like, all right, so let's help you. But I'm not putting you in a hotel, not giving you any money. But you're still my brother, and I'm still going to help you. But it's not merciful to let him not feel the consequences of his choices. It's merciful for him to feel the weight of them. So mercy limits mercy. So how do we actually be merciful?
Say
yes.
Can you say that again?
Which part? At the end?
It's not mercy.
It's not merciful to protect him from the consequences of his choices. So, and there are tons of new, and this is, you know, I'm not saying that that's the what we did the first time. Merciful sometimes says, you screwed up and I'm still going to help you. So this is after 2 years of walking with a guy where we bailed him out over and over. So again, don't go back to the cynicism and say, oh, you screwed up and it was your bad choice, so now you're screwed. You know, not saying that. That's not how God treats us, right? He doesn't say, all right, Chris, you've committed that sin 10 times. Forgiveness has run out. He doesn't do that. 70 times 70, over and over, we're forgiven and we're to forgive. But forgiveness and mercy are different. So there is a time when you limit mercy because it is merciful. All right. So again, I'm doing big picture stuff so we understand, so we can come back to the phone calls, but understanding what the purpose of the church is. What is the mission of the church? Suffering is the result of the broken relationship with God. And so the suffering, material, emotional, spiritual, all of it is a result of a fractured relationship with God. I like to think that there is no suffering that is not a result of one of three things. My sin, your sin, or original sin. Name a suffering that's not a result of one of those three things. There isn't one. You drive drunk and run into me and ruin my car and break my legs. Your sin affected me. The original sin that makes people want to drive drunk, all of these things are working in that situation. But every element of suffering in the world is a result of one of those factors. So what's the only cure for sin? The gospel, it's Christ. And so we're always pointing people back to Christ and to the broken relationship, but we also address some of the suffering that results. So we're trying to do these things in tandem at the same time. We're trying to keep them together. So the mission, I think, of the church, serve people holistically and point them to Christ. And what does holistically include? What are some of the dimensions of humanity?
The difficulty, I live in a world where holistic means salvation is everything.
Okay.
Teaching somebody how to read, teaching somebody to get their first job.
Yes.
In a typical church context, white, middle up across PCA, it's basically a credible confession of faith. So your friend obviously has done that, but obviously his life isn't what it should be.
Right.
So what went wrong? Was it his sin totally, or was it also the sin of the church not to recognize the gospel is larger than what we see it to be? Does that make sense?
I think so. What was wrong in that member's life?
Right, but also in the church's life, though, when it comes to understanding what you mean by holistic.
Yes.
And my responsibility to understand how I'm involved with his sin, because it's also my sin.
Yes, and his family's sin. So the holistic is recognizing that in that member that we're talking about is that his father, who abandoned him when he was a child, is a factor. The bipolar disorder that he has is a result of original sin. His predilection to use drugs and alcohol is a part of original sin. The church's selfishness and not wanting to get their hands dirty and really walk with somebody, and multiple churches beforehand. So recognizing that, yes, it's a good point, that not only is the individual holistic, but there's a whole array of problems. And so getting into all of this in its complexity is messy and difficult. But that's what we're called to do. If we just, what sometimes we end up being guilty of is the specialization mentality. You know, my wife has breast cancer and she's got tumors in the brain. So she's got a neurologist and she's got an endocrinologist and she's got this kind of oncologist and this kind of oncologist. She's got all these different specialists dealing with, and none of them want to comment on the other specialist's area of expertise. Oh, no, you're going to have to talk to your neurologist about that. No, 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 you're going to have to talk to the radiation oncologist about that because I'm the medical oncologist. And we can treat ministry that way, is chopping stuff up into all these different specialties. And I think the church is the one place where we can try to treat human beings completely. It doesn't mean we do everything for them. We don't solve everything. We partner with city agencies on housing and on financial assistance and, you know, substance abuse counselors and dental programs. But we're the hub of relationship that can be the advocate for the person, helping to tap into these things. So relational ministry, to me, is the thing that we're aiming towards in responding to these phone calls, is inviting people into relational ministry. So an example of where that didn't work. There's a church very close to my church, an Episcopal church that's across the street from a very low-income neighborhood, and they have a food pantry. And I'm talking one day to the guy who runs the food pantry. And I said, boy, you guys must get a lot of folks coming across the street to get food. And he said, oh, yeah, you know, we've had to scale back because we didn't have enough volunteers, and now we're just doing it Tuesdays, Thursdays. And I said, well, how do you decide, like, how much to give people, and how do you run the program? And he said, well, we've had a lot of problem with people not being honest with us. They would come in and misrepresent how many people they had in their apartment, say they had 5 people in the apartment, it was really just 1, and they were trying to get more groceries, and they wouldn't tell us the truth about how often they came and all these things. And I said, okay, well, what have you done to change things? And he said, well, what we decided is we don't know enough about these people and their lives. And I thought, okay, good, I'm leaning in. He said, so what we do now is have them go down to Department of Human Services, and they have to come back to us with a form that verifies their income level and how many people are in the household. And then when they give us the yellow form, we give them the right amount of groceries. And I was so sad. Why was I sad to hear that? They're not acting as the church.
They handed off the relational part.
They abdicated on the relational part because they decided that their mission was to hand out food. They said the job is to hand out bags of groceries. The problem is we're giving too many groceries to people who aren't telling the truth. The solution is to abdicate and farm out relationship building to a social worker, and then we just hand paperwork. What would have been a better solution? I know what I wish they'd done. What do you think?
We're going to visit you in your home.
Come visit you in the home. That's right. Go into the neighborhood. Physically across the street. So it's not like they had to drive, you know, across Dallas.
Anybody from the church live in that neighborhood?
Does nobody in the church lives in the neighborhood? No? But if they did, that would be good. Or someone maybe could move in the neighborhood. And I think they could have even just restructured how they handed out groceries that day. Instead of having two volunteers handing out groceries and checking forms, what if they'd gotten six volunteers each Tuesday and Thursday? Set up some tables and chairs, have some coffee, have some donuts. So the lady walks in for her groceries, and Julia says, "Hey, I'm Julia. Can we get a cup of coffee? Come sit down. Tell me, how can I be praying for you this week? I haven't seen you in a month. How's your daughter that we talked about last month? Is she feeling better? I want to pray for you. Do you have a Bible? Do you know when our Spanish service is?" Julia spends 20 minutes talking and praying with her, treating her like a human being, and then goes up to the counter and says, "Hey, can you get my friend her groceries now?" So you're still handing out groceries, but see how much different that is? Yes, it requires more volunteers. Yes, it takes more time. It's more complicated and difficult, but so are human beings. And so thinking in relational terms when we do ministry. And if you can't do something like that, then I'd say get out of the food pantry business. Get out of the clothes closet business. If there isn't a relational dimension where you're sometimes, some way, talking about Jesus and leading them back towards God, then I don't know if it's the business of the church to be doing that. So we talked about discernment. You know, why we feel uncomfortable in some of these situations, because we can't discern the truth. Well, how are you going to discern the truth about what's really going on in someone's life? You can't unless you spend time with them. So
intentional. The difficulty is no one's intentional.
Yeah. Why aren't people intentional?
I mean, it's two-sided sort. If the group you're talking about had realized if we took more time to interact,
yes.
More volunteers in a period of time, so you'd be more effective in what you're doing.
That's right.
And actually serve your population better.
Yeah.
But instead, they didn't want that, so it became a drain, which they lost their volunteers.
Yeah. Because, again, I think people want to volunteer often for something that's easy and doesn't drag me in. Now, I used to work at a homeless shelter in D.C., and we got a phone call once. I was sitting with the woman who ran our residential program for women, drug addiction, one-year recovery program, and a woman from the wealthy suburbs called and said, "Hey, Christmas is coming, and I'd like to send some gifts to the ladies there in the house. What would they like?" And Judy, the director of the house, said, "Yeah, we don't do that." And the woman said, "Well, what, don't the ladies need anything?" And she said, "Yeah, there are things they need, but I don't want to help you feel better about yourself at Christmas by sending gifts to these poor ladies in the city." I couldn't believe she said that, but this woman had been working for 30 years. She didn't care what anybody thought. And she said, "Here's what we can do. Wednesday nights we have dinner and Bible study. Why don't you come join us for dinner and Bible study? And after the Bible study, you can give your gifts to the ladies." So she was asking this lady from the wealthy suburbs to get in her car on a Wednesday night to come into one of the most dangerous parts of the city and actually sit down with crack addicts and spend time with them. That's not what the lady wanted. She wanted to alleviate her Christmas guilt by dropping some gifts in the mail. And I think too often our ministries are not as obviously like that, but at the heart, they are more like that. So, strong relationships. Now, taking care of family first. Acts 2 and Acts 4 talk about what the body of Christ looks like. We're going to talk about the Acts 2 some more. Do you remember the promise that's in Acts 4, what it said about the poor? There were no poor among them. There were no poor among them. But who were the them? It was the church. It was the believers. So there were no poor among them. So the first thing I'd say is if someone is a member of the body of Christ, they should never go hungry. They shouldn't have their lights out. If they're a covenant member of this church or my church, then their basic physical needs must be met. That is your responsibility as a church. Just take care of those physical needs. I tell our members, if someone gets laid off or loses their job, you know, if you would like me to talk to you about your financial situation, I'm available. One of the deacons can meet with you. But I do not want you to go into debt to pay your utilities or to buy food. Members of our church do not go into debt to take care of their basic needs. But if you have money in savings that you can tap into and those kind of things, great. If you have family you can rely on, great. But we take care of our own members. So at our church, our deacons fund takes in $130,000 a year. And 50% of that goes to members. And it's actually probably 40% now goes to regular attenders. So people who are in the pew most every Sunday. So only about 10% is going to these outreach, to responding to these phone calls. But there was a time when it was 30 or 40% was going to people for phone calls. But what we're trying to focus on is taking care of people who are in the context of covenant community.
Is that a rule or a statistic?
It's a result of our policies, not a rule. So I encourage people not to set a rule and say, no, we can't help you because we've passed a certain percentage threshold. But I think if your policies are good ones, if your principles are good, then that will be the fruit over time. So we call this a mercy ministry sandwich. And it's a model that we use based on Acts 2. And we explain this Acts 2 to every person who comes to the church looking for financial assistance. So here's the scenario of how it'll work. Is Julia calls the church, picking on you because you're close, but Julia calls the church and asks for help with her electric bill on Wednesday. The secretary at the church takes a phone call, just like we talk a lot, but what the secretary says is, our deacons would be happy to meet with you at church on Sunday. Come to worship, and after worship, the deacons will sit down with you, talk and pray with you about what's going on and see how we can help. And 90% of the people never come on Sunday. We're Alexandria Presbyterian. So where do we appear in the phone book? We're right up at the top. So if they don't get a quick yes, they often keep working through the phone book. But we do get, most every Sunday, we have somebody there who's to meet with the deacons. The reason I say that is because the deacons are very experienced at sharing this Acts 2 passage with Julia when they sit down to talk. And they'll bring in a woman from the Mercy Committee if it's Julia here. So you'll have a deacon or two and a woman or two there, and they sit down over coffee after worship and they talk. And the deacon will say something like, after talking to Julia and hearing some more about what's going on, the deacon will give Julia the Bible and say, I'm going to read these verses from Acts 2, Julia, and would you just tell me some of the things that you see that the church was doing. They devoted themselves to the apostles' teaching, fellowship, breaking of bread, and prayers. Same things we just did upstairs in worship, right? And that's what people are doing outside right now in the fellowship hall. They're having coffee. We've just had teaching, breaking bread. And then down at the bottom, they attended the temple together. They went to worship together. They broke bread in their homes. They praised God. These are the things that the body of Christ is doing right here today in our church, Julia. You've come to us because you're interested in the meat of the sandwich. You've come to us because you've heard that in the church, those who believe are together and have things in common, sell their possessions and belongings, distribute proceeds to all as any have need. And as a church, we believe that that helping of each other financially should be done in the context of everything else that the church does. Yeah.
Would you share that? Is that an aside to us here?
No. I'd say that to Julia.
You come for this part of it, but we're here to tell you that we do that, but there's a context to that.
Yes.
You would say that in those terms.
Yep. And because that's what we, and I even say it in historical terms, they were doing that 2,000 years ago. They were helping each other physically because they had all of these other things going on in their lives. It was a fruit of that relationship. And we would love to do all of these things together with you, Julia. And I know we're starting out by talking about your electric bill. But do you have a community like this? Have you ever been part of a church like that? And so we're trying to paint a picture of what it would be like to be part of a loving covenant community that is doing these things holistically and then invite Julia into that kind of community. And we have to do this with our own members sometimes too, who don't think that they're eligible for this kind of help, but say, look, you're a member of the church. This is what the Deacons Fund is for, to help each other.
Would it be also fair to say, you having that same part of the sandwich, that conversation, is it too much of a stretch to say, like, it's an entire sandwich. It's one complete sandwich that makes the full complete package.
Exactly. Yes, we want you to partake in the whole meal, because God knows you need all of these things in your life, and you know that you need them, Julie, right? Like, how did it feel to be here in the church? What kind of church did you grow up in? What was the experience? I mean, this whole experience, the deacons are going to very quickly make a decision whether they're going to help with the electric bill or not, or one part of it. They could figure that out in a 5 or 10 minute conversation with her, but they're going to spend 45 minutes with her, because she's a human being that God has brought into the church and sat down on a couch to interact with. And this is a God-ordained opportunity to get to know somebody and to pray for her.
So here's the devil's advocate talking. I work in an at-risk community that your church is going to have zip to do with. So what happens to those outside? I live in a Hispanic African-American community. So when it comes to the church's heart to move in,
yes,
you know, CCDA talk for a minute, this totally shuts that out. So back to, how can I expect Julia, who lives far away, to come to this church? She has no transportation.
Right.
If you were to say, I'm going to pick you up, different story.
Yes.
But is there a sense in which your church has a heart for communities around it where you choose to move in a way where you bring the gospel and what you're talking about still unfolds, but it's not strictly, you know, your church?
Right. So ultimately, what you're describing, your tag flipped around. Dave. So what Dave is describing is the proactive investment in a neighborhood and getting planted in there that is better than this. So skipping ahead a little bit, responding to these cold calls, responding to these people is exhausting, tiring, and it bears little fruit. That has been our experience. So one thing I encourage churches to do is to try to do less of this and more of the proactive investing in the community. Somebody up there asked about the church with the food pantry. Does anybody go into the neighborhood and get to know the people? Better yet, does anybody live in the neighborhood? If you want to have an impact on the poor, if you want to have an impact on hurting people, we got to get out of the reactive and into the proactive, the incarnational model. So I'm encouraging a better solution to a problem that's difficult from the beginning. That's part of the issue here, I think. You've got Julia. Can I keep using your name? All right. So Julia calls the church for electric help. The church is over here. On the other side of what? A big chasm, a big gap. There's not a relationship that exists between Julia and the church. One, because of what Dave said. The church has not gone into Julia's neighborhood and built a relationship. There may be socioeconomic, there may be ethnic, there may be all kinds of things that keep them separated. So there is no commonality or connection between them. And Julia has thrown this very thin line of connection by calling the church and asking for electric bill help. The only relationship that exists right now is, will you pay my electric bill or not? That's the definition of the relationship between Julia and the church. And if you say no, it's over. If you say yes, what's going to happen most of the time?
It's still over.
It's still over because the relationship was defined as pay my electric bill or not. Because Julia has defined the relationship in that way, and I'm not blaming her. It's just she's working the resources best she knows how. What is far, far better is when we're not reacting to people contacting us, but instead the church is proactively reaching out into a community and not with a thin thread of connection, but is laying down steel girders of relationship into a community proactively and saying, hey, we're here because we care about you. So we're tutoring your kids. So we're moving into your neighborhood. So we're doing an after-school program. So we're planting a church in your community. Whatever that looks like in your context, but now you're in the driver's seat and you're proactively saying, this is what we do. Daniel.
I get that. I think that's not even hard to see like how that begins to. It's a more helpful approach, a more proactive approach, and it's really not just putting things on sort of our terms to be reductionist about it, but it's enabling, it's equipping people to go out, and it's really equipping our people to kind of be the church outside the walls of the church. I still think it doesn't necessarily stop or mitigate the problem of still there are people that are going through the phone book and they're still going to land on your church. And so although I see like that is the ideal, when you do get put in this other situation happens, arises, I still want to be able to think really well about what happens in that. And it's still, I mean,
absolutely
different rabbit trails, but I still think it doesn't necessarily strip away the problem of having to have those phone calls and those conversations.
Exactly. So I would never want you to get to the point where you just say, oh, well, we have an after-school program, and we've planted a church in that neighborhood, so we don't take phone calls. So I'm not saying put up a brick wall to it, but inviting people to worship, inviting them into a financial management program, job training program, do you have things that you can plug them in that will start to address their true needs? And a lot of people are not going to be interested. A lot of people don't want that, but just like with the gospel, your job is to tell people about Jesus. Who bears the fruit? Who makes it happen? So we offer what we feel is responsible and what is biblical, and pray that people respond the way we would hope. Go ahead.
Yeah, just a comment on your comments and kind of what I'm hearing, and tell me if I'm wrong, and just in conversations through today. You know, one of our duties, whether we're a diaconate or not, is to build within our church a community.
Yes.
Financially assist, but that's a means to which we can actually reach and meet our real purpose, which is to share the good news with them and to bring them into the fold as Christ has brought us into the fold.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, the financial side is only just a mere means with which we start.
It's a component. The financial help is a component of it, yes. It's a part. Means, yes. I'm pushing back just a bit on means because sometimes people say, you know, that we're doing the financial help only so that we can share the gospel. And I don't think you're saying that, but it's a component because people really need the financial help.
Yeah, totally.
But recognizing that it is just as Jesus fed people who were really hungry, he healed people who were really broken, but always knowing that there was a bigger purpose, that they needed more than earthly bread, they needed living bread. And so how do we keep those together all the time? And I don't know, what's that?
Another one is spending time with them.
Spending time. They're relationally broken. They're emotionally broken. They're financially broken. They're sexually broken. All of these kinds of brokenness exist. And are we willing to create a forum where all those things can be addressed? And there's nothing better we can offer a broken world than the body of Christ. So your congregation, exactly who it is and where it is God's best solution to poverty. The challenge is getting people in the pew, in the congregation, being loved by a community of faith and finding ways to build the bridge. So I'm going to quickly move through just these five pieces of advice, and these are in your handout. Deacons should lead. I don't even need to read this from Book of Church Order, but it's the job of deacons. It's a spiritual office. It's not stacking chairs and balancing budgets. That's not what deacons are primarily called to do. And sometimes people, to solve this problem, will hire somebody to be their director of community engagement, and that person's not a deacon or involved in the deacons. And I find that sad, because it's the deacon's job to lead these ministries and do them in partnership with others. We have a mercy committee of 23 people who work with the 10 deacons. So you need more people, but the deacons should be leading us. The deacons should have help. This is where we come up with our mercy committee out of BCO 9-7. Appoint godly men and women to assist the deacons in caring for the sick, the orphans, the widows. So creating a larger team that can build relationships. The primary job, I tell our mercy committee, is to just be a friend to somebody. So whether it's the person who's called the church looking for help, whether it's the many refugees and people who've come for political religious asylum, that's where we've opened the faucet. So we've been tightening the faucet on the financial help we give to cold callers, and we've opened a faucet to refugees and asylees. And so we've got 35 refugees and asylees from Africa and from Iraq that have become part of the congregation. And so that's who we're primarily helping now. And the congregation loves it because they're helping people that are sitting in the pew with them, right? So when Daniel from Ethiopia, who was persecuted by the government there and fled for his life, when I met him, he was living on a bench in a bus shelter. And when he became part of the church and we began helping him with his asylum process, one of the deacons took him in and he was staying in their house and then would help Daniel with English classes. Eventually, he got permission from Homeland Security to bring his wife and daughters here once his asylum was approved. He got up in front of the church and said, guys, church, we have an opportunity to bring Daniel's family here. We've been praying for them for the last year, but the deacons have to buy the plane tickets. 4 plane tickets from Ethiopia is going to be expensive, so please remember that when you give to the deacons fund. So normally we get $5,000 or $6,000 a month in the deacons fund. That day we got $16,000 because they knew Daniel. They wanted to see Daniel's family there, so people gave. And a month later, got up in front of the church and said, remember we asked for help in the deacons fund last month to fly Daniel's family? Well, guess what? There they are. Daniel's wife and daughter stand up. Congregation goes nuts. And then people are already, well, we already had a team established, but we had a team established who were going to help Amarich and the girls get registered for school, get their TB tests, get their immunizations, go shopping, you know, get clothes, go to the thrift store and get clothes and furniture. And the congregation jumped in and helped because this wasn't some stranger. This was someone in our church. So when we're doing this, building bridges into the community, we're building bridges in a way that we're going to build a relationship of trust and love with Julia, and we're going to bring her back to church, and we're going to get her involved in the church community. And I don't know what that'll look like in your context, but how do you get people in the pew so that they're being loved and cared for by the congregation? That is my number one piece of advice.
So how do you get the pew to them?
And sometimes you have to take the pew to them. Sometimes you need to plant a church in that neighborhood, start a Bible study in that neighborhood, especially if there are those big barriers.
Because racism and classism you haven't talked about is huge.
Sure.
So the refugee population can fit, but the black kids I work with won't fit.
Yes.
You would kick them out.
We wouldn't. Yeah, I would hope not, but
that's exactly what I was getting ready to say. How do you bring people from the backyard into the church, which are, as you would call them, cold callers?
Mm-hmm.
I don't think of them as cold callers. I think of them as the people that live around the church, the people that live, you know, right down the street, the people that are sleeping in the park a half a block away.
Yeah.
You know, sometimes if you bring those people into the church,
some others in the church won't like that.
Well, so,
is that what you were going to say? I'm sorry.
Well, they're not being allowed to come into the church a lot of the time.
Mm.
You know, without like getting too far into it, I know of examples people were brought into the church in an addiction, were able to express the help that they needed, were able to do their best to do what the church was asking. But sometimes when people are off in addiction, sometimes when people have been raped and, you know, their houses have been broken into on multiple occasions, they're not so easy to say, oh, okay, let's go to church and tell all the church people all of our business.
Right,
and
right.
They're going to help us, you know. They don't do that. You have to work with them. You have to be
yes.
patient with them. You have to help to mold them to lay that foundation.
Right.
And then if you can lay that foundation, then after years of them saying that I want to change but I don't have any support because either I really don't have any support or because I don't trust my support, they will start to trust.
Right.
You know, and then they will also, just like little Daniel, become members of that church family, and that church will be their family, and they will be able to stand proud and be able to want to give service for that church.
Yes.
And be able to say from the bottom of their heart, these are my sisters, these are my brothers, these are my aunts,
yes.
my spiritual mothers. You know, because I know when I was at my worst, these people did not give up on me.
Yes.
They did not say, oh, we met you at the parking lot or, you know what I mean, whatever. They started slow, still, just like they did Daniel.
And they hung in with you and they worked to overcome the distrust. I mean, as you're saying, when we're talking about racial history, we're talking about distrust, we're talking about the evils of sin and the historical sin that exists between races and classes and different neighborhoods and different cities, that's where the proactive part comes in, because many people are not going to feel comfortable in your upper middle class white church, or they're going to assume they're not welcome, even if you have the best of intentions. This is kind of an aside, but I'm reading a book called Gracism right now by a guy named David Anderson, and I love, he talks about gracism as the opposite of racism. Racism is when I actively hate and exclude another person, right? That's racism. It's active. Now, most people these days would say, well, I'm not a racist. Those people are welcome in my church, right? They can come. The door's open. Anybody's welcome. But it's a passive attitude towards other communities. It's just saying, yeah, the door's open. Come on in. Gracism is as active as racism. And what do you think it's actively doing? Actively seeking, actively loving, actively trying to include.
You tell the real story. I mean, he's an African American guy who worked with Bill Hybels and was pulled over by a police officer thinking, I'll never experience what you just mentioned, and he did.
Yeah.
So the purpose of the book, which I love too,
yeah.
is to show that it's very difficult for African Americans to fit in the culture of a white church. For Hispanic churches, speak Spanish only. You come into any church that's not Spanish speaking. And so it's not an easy journey to pursue in most churches that are homogeneous, you know, whether it's African American,
right. white. And I think the problem and the reason why so many churches are homogeneous, whether black, Latino, white, Asian, is because it's easier to be with people like you. We all feel more comfortable, but the gospel paints this picture of this multicultural, multiracial, multi-socioeconomic, multi-everything, all being together. And it's harder and it's more difficult than staying separate. But that's what we're called to do, is to do the messy, difficult work of reconciliation, of talking about historic and present-day sin and racism and asking for forgiveness and giving forgiveness and learning from each other, and praying in different styles, and worshiping in different styles. And that's the PCA especially has a long way to go in that. But the way to get there is with this active kind of outreach into the community. We've got 6 minutes, so I'm going to keep. Yeah, let me just run through just a couple more practical things on responding, And I think I have all these in the white handout as well. But you guys, I don't even have to tell you, you don't give cash, like never. recognize that you're always trying to build a relationship, that you're trying to draw people into relationship. And physical things can be a part of that, but they're an expression of love. So have things on hand that you can give other than cash. Have a food pantry. Have gift cards. Give somebody a Bible if they don't have one. Find ways to give. And partner with others. So even if you aren't going to be giving them any financial help, but you know of other organizations or you know social work programs and you become their advocate. Many times people don't have an advocate who's going to be their friend and say, well, let me call Human Services for you. Or let me call the utility company because I know they have a program. And if I call, maybe I can help you get enrolled in the program. If you're an advocate and a friend, you're expressing love and you're breaking down some of that distrust where they think, well, I can't trust that person because of how different they are than me. And when you become their advocate and friend, you're showing that maybe you can be trusted. So I already mentioned giving primarily to members, regular attenders, outreach, but trying to expand who are the members and the regular attenders is the key. And then proactive. I keep talking about proactive. So our deacons were sitting around reading James 1:27 once where it said, religion our Father finds pure and faultless is to, what? Care for widows and orphans. And our deacon said, we don't have any widows in the church. We were like 300 people at the time. We realized we had no widows. So we're like, we can't do what we're being told to do. So the deacons decided to import widows. So they bought a bus with a handicap lift, and they started going to two high-rise facilities across town where some seniors lived and said, hey, does anybody want to come to church? And immediately there were 10 or 12 men and women who had been dying to come to church but had no way to get there. And then this whole little Bible study started. This whole class started right afterwards, and one of the elders came up, and people who'd never really been involved in ministry suddenly wanted to help out with this one. It was finally the ministry that fit them. And then some of those seniors became members of the church. And one of them joined the Mercy Committee and started helping reach out to others. And now we have two Bible studies in those two residences. But just like the proactive thing, like we didn't say we don't like widows. We don't like seniors. They were welcome, but we had to go get them. We had to go get them and bring them into the church. So we had to be proactive. And so with the refugees and asylees, we've had to talk to social workers who work with the refugees and say, if you have someone who needs help and wants to get help from a church community, please let me know. And the social workers call and say, yeah, we got a new refugee. He just arrived from Morocco. He was persecuted for becoming a Christian. Can you help him? Yes, we will. And so we build those relationships. Be the church. I think we've covered that. So some resources, and then we'll have like 2 more minutes for questions. Just some books. So I put that one in yellow so I wouldn't forget to mention it. So you could have saved yourself time and not really come to this and read this book that came out 2 weeks ago. So When Helping Hurts, Corbett and Fickert just came out with a book 2 weeks ago, Helping Without Hurting in Church Benevolence. And they cover a ton of the same stuff that we just talked about and why and how to do it. They even have in there, this is a handout we'll give you on the way out. This is a form we use that as the relationship starts to develop, we have a form called a plan of action form where we talk about goals and directions. And I adapted this from the Christian Reformed Church, and then they put it in their book also. It's got a budget on it, and it talks about how to structure that conversation so that you're making a plan and working in partnership with somebody. So drawing someone into a relationship for lasting change. All right, last questions, comments. Yes, ma'am.
I truly, truly believe that the more a person is open to sanctification, the more a person is open to moving forward in their sanctification, it's not that hard to love someone that's different than you are.
Yeah. I think you're right.
You know, I was that person that came into the church and was like, oh my God, I'm not like anybody here. And they were like, yeah, you're just like us.
Yeah.
You just have Jesus.
That's right.
You know, and I was
you know, we can't give you no money, but you're more than welcome to come in here every single day and use our computers, you know, and try to find a job. That the women were like, come to our Bible study. We already have the book for you. You know, the book is $14, but we already have it for you. Do you need a ride?
Yeah. They loved you and they invited you into community.
Right. But it was up to me to come in here.
Yes.
It was up to me to be ready. It was up to me to pay attention, you know, and that's how the relationship built. It wasn't from searching far and wide. It was from just acknowledging one little cold caller, you know, that when you said no to this, but yes to this, said, okay, let's try this.
Yeah.
You know, and you take one step and I'll try to take as many as I can.
Yes.
And you take one step and I'll try to take as many as I can. And I am a true believer now that I cannot be more concerned with your situation than you are.
That's right.
You know, if you don't care, how can I care?
Yeah.
But if you show me that you care, then I'm going to try to care almost as much as you. I can never care more than you.
Exactly. And so, if we're confident in what we're offering, if we're confident in the identity of who we are as a church, what our mission is reconnecting people to their Creator, dealing with some of the symptoms of the fall in their suffering, and then we have good plans in place where we can help people grow in relationship, grow in grace, learn all these, and then people are going to say yes, and they're going to say no to what we offer, and that is not our responsibility. Our responsibility is to offer good, biblical, loving, open help, and proactively reach out, and then let the Lord work out what He will.
Mention your book.
Mention my book?
Yeah, I've read it, so you don't know me, but no, it's a great book. So,
Tangible by some doofus. So my book is Tangible, Making God Known Through Deeds of Mercy and Words of Truth. And it's trying to keep word and deed together and not separate. So you're not doing only evangelism or only relief, but you're trying to always keep them together. And there are no more copies out there, but it's all right. It's out there on Amazon and stuff.
I've been selling them for
years. So that's where they all went. All right, let me pray. Lord, thank you for this time with my friends. I pray that it would not be just 75 minutes of talk, but that we would all go back to our churches and we would be thinking about how we can proactively, effectively love people, especially those who might not feel comfortable in our community, that might feel ostracized, separated, that there is a history of racism and oppression and bad blood in our neighborhoods, in our communities. And I pray that you would supersede and overwhelm and crush all of those things and build loving relationships with those in our community so that we might grow together in Christ and we might help people in ways that truly helps, dealing with some of the symptoms of the fall, but ultimately experiencing all the kingdom blessings that there are in growing in Christ. So thank you for what you've done and what you will do, and we ask it all in Jesus' name. Amen. Amen. Thanks, y'all.